Hey, hey, this is Thurston. You're listening to CJSF 90.1 Burnaby. Yeah, keep listening.
Hello, and welcome to the Canadian Philosophy Show. I'm your host, Brandon, and today I am joined with Hale once again. Today we are going to be doing something a little different, a little kind of experimental, I would guess, because what we will be doing today is not necessarily, like, we've done shows in the past where we have done readings together, even like live on air. I think we read the Plato's Ion at one point, quite a short work. We're going to be going through a text. We'll be reading from it. It has an interesting kind of premise. There's a little bit of, I suppose, lore to it. Today we will be reading Wittgenstein's Tractatus Logico-Philosophicus. But the premise, or kind of the twist of the show, is that I have been going through a metaphysics and the philosophy of language class. If you're familiar with the Tractatus, you'll understand that what place that has in that field. If you aren't familiar with the Tractatus, that's okay. We'll be talking about it.
And Wittgenstein is someone that if anyone is relatively familiar with, especially modern philosophy, they're going to know, at least know the name Wittgenstein. And he's someone that I know as being really important. And I enjoyed working on bits and pieces of him during my time in university and particularly in that class. But also Wittgenstein is someone who is known for being quite difficult. At the end of the day, even my exposure through a upper-level philosophy course, an undergraduate degree, was, in the grand scheme of things, pretty minor. And you've clearly spent a lot more time understanding Wittgenstein and studying particularly the Tractatus and stuff like that.
Because we spent a couple months together, it was a better part of that course. So we were on a par. Now I've kind of gone and spent another month reading this text. This is with the same professor, by the way, interestingly enough. So at least I'm getting like a consistent exposure. And I have to say, going through it a second time, it's not like I remembered everything from that first class, but it at the same time, it felt like this is not my first rodeo. I feel a bit more familiar with it. I'm approaching it from just not for the first time. So I feel like while, of course, even Wittgenstein scholars are in disagreement about how to interpret the Tractatus and they still have problems or questions about it, that is to say that a definitive reading doesn't really exist for as complete a work as the Tractatus is, I feel like I'm in a position to elaborate or explain some of the very basic concepts, and especially I think some of the sort of initial concepts that Wittgenstein lays out, which I think from my reading of it, if you grasp the first couple moves that the text is making, and if you can discern what's kind of going on behind an enormously terse text, then you really do set yourself up to understand metaphorically, but this is the metaphor that Wittgenstein himself uses, to understand that first rung of the ladder, right?
Yeah, and I think two things that like have come up for me as you're speaking with that. One is, for our listeners, like, yeah, you're going to be explaining Wittgenstein and trying to reiterate that to me and to our listeners as well. Like, Wittgenstein's style is not only is it conceptually difficult, but his style is also very technical, would be maybe the right way to put it. It's not like a smooth read.
It's interesting, right? I mean, he is considered difficult not just because of the framework of his thought, which is counterintuitive, and he's trying to be counterintuitive because he thinks that the intuitions that we rely on when at the time, so like just for like very quick context, Bertrand Russell and Frege and later G.E. Moore as well at the time, they are there's a kind of logical atomism and the initial push of like logical positivism Wittgenstein is like associated with beginning the logical positivist movement with the Tractatus, and then like the Vienna Circle emerges and stuff like that. But really, the beginnings of that are in Frege, who formulates a symbolic logic that is like the first real push in logic since Aristotle.
Just for me and listeners, because I'm gonna play a little bit dumb here. If you were to explain logical positivism in that general school in like a couple sentences, what would it be?
Yeah. So logical positivism is a school of thought specifically associated with the analytic tradition. So in the analytic continental tradition, the logical positivists are seen as kind of that first initial push of analytic philosophy, which is associated with and really concerned with principles of verification. And also what's called the linguistic term, but I can get to that in a second. What's really central to philosophy is clearing up the grounds for investigations so that we don't spin our wheels doing, you know, pointless or fruitless or trivial or just nonsensical like philosophical investigations or scientific investigations, right? So the positivists are concerned with trying to find principles of verification such that this is how you, like, these are the principles by which sense is made. And then there is an area, you know, call it whatever you want. To the positivists, it doesn't matter because they're not concerned with it, where that stuff is just nonsense. So one example of that would be like metaphysics, right? Metaphysical propositions are not conducive of being either true or false, and so they can't be investigated.
So that's like when you say, and I think for listeners too, it's worth noting, when you say, because verification obviously is huge in logical positivism, and that's the kind of groundswell from which Wittgenstein comes from, you're dealing with basically the truth value of things. Can a statement be true? Can some philosophical statement, whatever, can that be verified to be true or false?
Yeah, essentially.
It being true or false is not like the value judgment in and of itself of like, oh, that's good or bad. It's just literally something like, you know, you can, so philosophical statement might be, it hurts to, you know, kill other people or something. That's kind of a weird one, but whatever. Like, it's kind of an ethical statement. That is a statement which could be true or false, whether or not we know it's the case, right? There is some level of verifiability in that. Whereas a statement like, you know, there are three round squares, you know, in the next universe.
Yeah, yeah.
I know that's not absurd, but the point is that, like, there's nothing to work with there.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah, the logical positivists would say that that's just nonsense, and since it's nonsense, it's not conducive of being verified in any way at all. So it's just none of our concerns. Now, I should say, the positivists do emerge out of the kind of the results or the fruits of the Tractatus, right? So that is, the logical positivists and their concerns with principles of verification are also Wittgenstein's concerns. One of the concerns that Wittgenstein, he's essentially elaborating the conditions for logic, and he sees himself as revising earlier logical atomism, which was what Bertrand Russell and G.E. Moore were working on, right? Now, the reason that G.E. Moore and Bertrand Russell are worth bringing up is that if you're familiar with Russell, if there's anything you know about Russell, it might be Russell's paradox, right? Now, Russell's paradox is a particular problem that he noticed in Frege's elaborations of trying to reduce mathematics to logic, right? Because what Frege was interested in doing was taking all propositions and being able to reduce them to quantifiable logic so that they can all become commensurate, and then you kind of have a theory of everything from that. Russell found a problem with that, where he found that if you try, because what Frege is trying to do is talk about sets, and he's using set theory to classify all kinds of propositions and whatnot and numbers. But the set, the set of all sets that doesn't include itself is not a set that, that makes sense within this within this system, right? So it can't be, it can't account for everything. And apparently Frege got really upset about that and stopped doing philosophy when Russell found that out.
So say that crux for us one more time. The set of all sets that doesn't include itself can't be the case.
Yeah, it can't be included in a comprehensive set theory. Now Wittgenstein is interested in trying to resolve this problem, and he thinks that the reason that this problem, because here's the thing, if you run into a paradox, that doesn't mean, okay, if you're a metaphysician, if you think that there is like nature and supernature, this might just seem like, whoa, nature's really weird. There's just something about reality that we don't understand. But usually if you're more logically minded, if you're a mathematician, you think, okay, if we run into a paradox, that actually just means we've like elaborated our situation wrong. So we need to go back to the drawing board and try and figure out what's actually going on here, right? And that was what Wittgenstein sought to do. So I say this by way of trying to distance Wittgenstein from logical atomism, because he's sometimes understood as being consistent with Russell, whereas he oftentimes expresses his frustrations with Russell. He was quite irate when Russell insisted that his preface, Bertrand Russell wrote the preface to the Tractatus. He went to Routledge to get it to get the Tractatus published, but he would only do it on the condition that he got to publish he got to put his preface in it. The preface does not understand the Tractatus at all. Wittgenstein was really upset, but he eventually ceded. Bertrand Russell thinks that Wittgenstein is doing logical atomism, which essentially reduces all items in a proposition to logical atoms, right? Propositions are composed of names, and those names combine to make propositions and stuff like that. Wittgenstein is going to essentially flip that logic on its head, because he thinks that logic is the source of philosophical problems themselves. This is not just about resolving Russell's paradox. This is not just about, you know, tidying up Frege's really interesting logical works. Wittgenstein understands that this work is, he understands that it's going to have the impact that it has, right? Because this solves all philosophical problems, because the logic, the understanding of language that produces philosophical problems is this. And if you revise that understanding of how logic works, all of the philosophical problems, all of the apparent paradoxes that we encounter in philosophy, all of these deep and eternal questions evaporate, right? That's why in the preface, the preface is one of the most important parts of the text itself. On the other hand, he mentioned something earlier. If this work has any value in it, it consists in two things. The first is that thoughts are expressed in it, and on this score, the better the thoughts expressed, the greater its value. On the other hand, the truth of the thoughts that are here communicated seem to be unassailable and definitive. He thinks he solved all the problems, right? I therefore believe myself to have found on all essential points the final solution of the problems of philosophy. If I am not mistaken in this belief, then the second thing in which the value of this work consists is that it shows how little is achieved when these problems are solved. The profundity that philosophers profess when we discuss, you know, the mind-body problem, or these gaps in epistemology and skepticism, or, you know, the nature of God or something like that. These are simply the results of misunderstanding the logic of language. And once we resolve that misunderstanding, not only does it solve the problem, it doesn't solve the problems in that it gives like an answer to them, but it shows that these questions didn't make sense to raise in the first place. So you can see why the positivists were really, really, really excited by this, right? We, we don't have to solve metaphysical problems. We can just find the limits of language and then call it a day, because there's only the natural sciences to talk about, as Wittgenstein will say. Everything else, you can just stop talking, right? That's why later on, Wittgenstein would kind of... he's not a positivist, because he does think that... Well, he's a positivist insofar as he thinks that only... natural propositions that refer to the world or to that are assertions of natural science make any sense. He agrees with the positivists in that, but he is not in agreement with the positivists insofar as the positivists are they trivialize the what can't be said. Or so one of the things that in terms of like what would a positivist moral theory look like, one of the things that they argued for was emotivism, right? Which is essentially just the idea that since moral statements or ethical statements can't be verified for their good or badness, they're more or less just saying boo or yay, right? Wittgenstein takes ethics and aesthetics and all of those very seriously, and that is the latter half of the book that the positivists end up kind of neglecting. But he does get charged as what's called a quietist. So, you know, where if one cannot speak, one must remain silent. So you can't talk about ethics. Well, yes, you can. It's just not a science is really all he's talking about. I've been talking a lot kind of just by way of background. And I think that it's useful to have that background because you understand what Wittgenstein's project is. He, as he says, again, from the preface, the book deals with the problems of philosophy and shows, I believe, that the reason why these are posed is that the logic of our language is misunderstood. The whole sense of the book might be summed up in the following words. What can be said at all can be said clearly, and what we cannot talk about, we must pass over in silence. Thus, the aim of the book is to draw a limit to thought, or rather not to thought, but to the expression of thoughts. So there are thoughts that you can have that can't be expressed. That's what he'll call the mystical.
Well, express, and I think it should be clear, like, when you say they're expressed in a way that would be acceptable to, like, the logical positivists, or acceptable to, you know, philosophical, like, you know, basically, as we were talking about earlier, would have some level of truth value.
Yeah, essentially.
Or things that we could point at and be like, this is something which is or is not the case.
Yeah, does this, can the truth or falsity of this proposition be verified by a principle of verification, right? And then the task after that becomes, okay, well, what is the principle of verification? Then we get Karl Popper's this logic of scientific investigation, where it's falsifiability. So in any case, what Wittgenstein's project is to set up the conditions for that investigation, that propositions have true or false, that sense-making propositions have truth or falsity to them, and if a proposition doesn't make sense, it's because it's neither true nor false. It just doesn't make sense to say at all. So, with that, I think we will jump into the first kind of portion of the actual text itself. Again, the preface is very important to understanding the text. It doesn't contain the text, but it's very helpful in understanding Wittgenstein's project, but the nitty gritty of the book itself is where people encounter the terseness that they're used to hyping up with Wittgenstein. And I think that terseness is quite justified. If you turn to, so I'm reading from the Piers and McGuinness translation, just for anyone who's concerned about that. The text itself is set up with a numbering system. Now, when I studied with my professor, he actually said that the numbering system, don't get too hung up on it, which in a way for me was kind of nice, because it was one less barrier to the text. But also, I think the thing to think about with the numbering system is it should be treated as a heuristic device. It's not that it should be ignored or that it is, like, you know, crystalline in its exhaustiveness. You know, he's not I think it is useful for figuring out how the propositions relate to each other and when you need certain propositions. So I will start with the ones. Oh, by the way, I should say, for anyone listening who doesn't have the text themselves, the text itself is quote-unquote simple. It's quite short, but you can think of it as seven propositions. It's just seven sentences long. The book is seven sentences long. Then the book is also accompanied by many annotations, right? So the ones are a very good example of this. So proposition one, the world is all that is the case. Proposition 1.1 is the world is the totality of facts, not of things. So 1.1 is just a comment on one, right? 1.11, the world is determined by the facts, and by there being all the facts, is a comment on 1.1. So the more digits you go in, the more you get on commentary, whereas 1.1 is preceded by 1.2. So 1.1, the world is the totality of facts, not of things. 1.2, the world divides into facts. So that is like, that's like a sentence not being nested, but following it, right? Everything between and that, so, is a comment.
At the risk of opening up like a rabbit hole, I think it's, was it, so when we look at state, statement one, or sentence one, however you want to put it, and we go, the world is a totality of facts, not things. That's one, correct? Now, when Wittgenstein says world, what are we?
Yeah.
What do you interpret him as meaning within that phrase?
Yeah, that's a good question. I interpret him as meaning everything, or everything that, because here's the thing, for Wittgenstein, propositions only make sense, and this is anticipating a little bit, but I think that's okay. Propositions only make sense when they propositions only have sense when they relate to the world, right? So if I were to say the cat is on the mat, that is a, whether it's true or false, we don't know yet, because we haven't looked to see if the cat is on the mat yet. But because it refers to a world where we can check, it's a sense-making proposition, right? Its truth or falsity has not yet been determined, but that doesn't stop it from making sense, right? Whereas with one of the propositions of the kind that you were referring to later, you know, the four-sided triangle smiles angrily, that's not a proposition that, what does determining the truth or falsity of that, what would that even look like? Because a four-sided triangle doesn't make sense, right? You can't check the world for that. So I see the ones section as more or less being the statement that Wittgenstein is saying, I am talking about everything. I am giving the principle of the exhaustibility of the text. This is
and everything for Wittgenstein in this case isn't just like literally everything that exists, in the sense of like, okay, well, we take up all the like a materialist perspective, right? We take up all the little things that exist in the world, and every little matter of energy and atom and thing that you have in yourself, blah blah blah. Like, in a way, it's kind of like building off that, but it's like, it's all the statements about those things and all the potential statements of things which could be the case but are not.
Yeah, that's really important to say too. So again, anticipating, because truth or falsity depends on things being the case or not being the case, the world is all that, it's literally the first line, the world is all that is the case. There's an important distinction that Wittgenstein is going to draw between the world and reality. Now, reality is all the possible facts, and since facts can either be true or false, reality is, it's not more expansive than the world, because the world, so like if you look out at the world, you don't see things that are not the case. You can only see things that are the case. But we can make and compose sentences that are false because they don't accord with the facts, right? So there has to be a, it's what Wittgenstein calls Wirklichkeit, right? If you'll remember the distinction between Wirklichkeit and Realität. Realität is that worldly reality to which things must sort of correspond, whereas Wirklichkeit is situations that make sense as being either true or false, but that don't correspond to the world yet, right?
Well, yeah, it's not, Wirklichkeit is not necessarily concerned with correspondence. It's, again, it's like, it's, for example, we could say something like, Trudeau and Mao were the best of friends. Now, obviously, that's a thing that's, like, not, everybody knows who's, like, actually alive, though that's not true, but it's a thing that does make sense, and in some, you know, there is, because it makes sense, we can effectively sign it a truth value of being false, right? But that's only because it could conceivably be true.
Yeah, yeah. The important thing, so one of the reversals that Wittgenstein is making from the logical atomists before him, so Frege and Russell want to say that truth is, a thing being true is what makes it sensible, right? Wittgenstein wants to actually invert that relationship and say that actually you can't determine the truth or falsity of something unless it makes sense to you, right? So in your example, like Mao and Trudeau are friends, whether that's true or false, it's unlike, not likely at all. But in any case, it's a sentence that makes sense to you. The form of that proposition is something such that, okay, I know how to go about, like, verifying this. Like, we'd go look for correspondence between them. Did they ever meet? You know, did they share ideologies or anything? You know, you could go out and... So it's interesting that despite not knowing the truth or falsity of it, there are things that you understand about that proposition. And that's what Wittgenstein is pointing up is really important, that sense and... it's possible for propositions to make sense or no, it's not that it's possible for proposition to be nonsense, because for Wittgenstein, a nonsense proposition isn't a proposition at all. He would say that that's just like metaphysics. It's just not, it's a misuse of language essentially. But the fact that we have meaningful language prefigures our determining the truth or falsity of things, which is the error, one of the errors that the logical atomists were making prior to him.
And just, I'm just going to step in and just say real quick that you're listening to the Canadian Philosophy Show, and I'm one of your hosts, Hale, and with me is Brandon. And today we're discussing, in relative depth for a single episode, Wittgenstein's Tractatus.
Mm-hmm. So we've been talking a bit about, we've gotten a little bit into the text. We've talked about the ones. The ones are not actually, I don't find, they're more, again, they're just more or less the conditions of exhaustion. He's talking about everything. He's talking about everything.
Say one again, just for the listeners.
Yeah, so proposition one, the world is all that is the case.
Yeah, boom.
Yeah, there it
sure.
is.
Sure, that sounds believable.
Yeah. The interesting stuff, and where I actually think that, and this will probably be the rest of what we talk about, because I think that I don't want to go so far as to say that the book is contained in the twos, but at the same time, everything that people sort of want to understand or that gets discussed in the scholarship is contained in the twos. And I think that those two things that are in the twos do give you, again, the first rung. And once you have the first rung, you're already kicking down the ladder, as Wittgenstein would say. So let's get into that. So proposition, and just to, again, give us a, because I think it's important to have like a roadmap of where we're going. Those two things that we're going to be exploring in the twos are the relationship between states of affairs and objects. So we're going to talk about what their kind of nature is and what gets called the picture theory. I call it quote unquote picture theory. I have opinions on the picture theory and whether it should be called that or not, but we will get to that. The relation between objects and states of affairs will give us